From Vermont Public and the NPR Network, this is Brave Little State. I'm Burgess Brown.
And I'm Lola DeFore. If you ask a hunter how they got into hunting, you're likely to hear something like this.
My dad hunts, so I kind of grew up around hunters.
I had hunting in the family, so I just grew up hunting.
I've been raised from hunting. My family hunted and all that.
And that's what I heard, what you just heard, when I sat down with a group of high school boys in Danville. Now, the reason I'm talking to you about hunting today is because of Alex Larrabee. She's a sophomore at Danville, a K-12 school in the Northeast Kingdom. I'm the youth and education reporter at Vermont Public, and so for this episode, my Brave Little State debut, I thought it'd be fun to collect questions from high school students around the state and then put our favorites up for a public vote. And Alex Larrabee's question won. She wanted to know about how hunting has changed in Vermont, if it's gotten more or less popular over time. But she's not just curious about statistics.
I've always wondered, like, what is the fascination of hunting? Like, why do people like to hunt so much?
Now, Alex doesn't hunt, but a lot of the people around her do. Her dad hunts, her older sister, who's now in the military, she hunted. And as you heard, a ton of her classmates, mostly boys, they hunt. And what she's noticed is that the people who go hunting, they love it. Here's another one of Alex's classmates, Sebastian Eldred.
I just look for, like, counting down the days every day, every year, to whatever season it is.
It can be kind of boring to be a teen anywhere, especially in a rural town. But the kids who hunt, Alex says it feels like they look forward to the weekend in a way few people do.
It's not like a casual thing. A lot of the people I know, they hunt like every day after school and they hunt like all weekend.
Like Dylan Costa.
How big a part of your life is hunting?
It's most of my life. If, like, during the summertime when nothing's open, I'm pretty well bored. I look forward to hunting all year round. Like right now, turkey season isn't until May, and I'm already looking forward to that, so.
I've also noticed how emotionally potent it is. Sure, hunting is kind of this ubiquitous thing in Vermont culture. There's camo and hunter's orange everywhere. In November, a lot of local shops will advertise hunter's widow sales, you know, for the partners who are quote-unquote left behind during hunting season. But it's the way hunting animates people that interests me and that interests Alex. And her observation that people who hunt don't really do it casually, it's actually borne out by the state's licensing data. If someone gets, say, a fishing license, maybe they'll get one next year, and maybe they won't. But it's not the same with hunting. If you hunt one year, you're almost certainly going to hunt the next, and the next, and the next. People who hunt basically hunt until they can't anymore. I don't hunt. So I figured the best way, and probably the only way, to answer Alex's questions about who hunts and why the heck they like it so much was to head into the woods and see for myself. I hope you'll tag along.
Support for Brave Little State comes from Northshire Bookstore, with books, gifts, vinyl records, and more for all ages. Located in Manchester, Vermont, Saratoga Springs, New York, and online at northshire.com. And Efficiency Vermont, proud sponsor of Drive Electric Vermont. Information about charging on the road, model comparisons, and rebates is at driveelectricvermont.com.
Morning.
Good morning.
How do you feel?
I feel awful.
Can I pass you this coffee?
It's an hour before dawn, and my producer Burgess and I are headed to an undisclosed mountain in Addison County. We're not going to be too specific as to where, because Alex Smith, not to be confused with our question asker Alex Larrabee, has asked us to please not blow up his spot.
Not that, like, this is a big secret or something, but it's a good spot. And
it's like a good swimming spot.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Alex is our hunter guide and one of the nicest people I've ever met. When we meet up with him, dawn is breaking. And while that's extremely early for me, It's actually pretty late for Alex, who would have been out here by 4 o'clock if it weren't for us.
You'll see the sun rising over Mount Abe and the mountains in Lincoln, and you'll see the Adirondacks sort of, you know, begin to
We're parked on a logging road, and Alex is holding a bowl of oatmeal and blueberries while he's talking. But I don't think Burgess and I ever catch him taking a single bite. He's just too excited.
And it's just like the most, there's no other time of day like it. All the birds kind of start coming alive in the springtime, especially.
If you couldn't tell already, Alex is an extremely avid hunter. He's been doing it most of his life. And now he's on the leadership team for the Vermont chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. And he's so good at hunting that today, just 3 days into Vermont's rifle season, he's already bagged a buck in Vermont and another in New York, which is all he's allowed for the season. But he's generously found two other people who still have deer tags, and that's who we're meeting in the woods. Bailey Walker, a Middlebury College student who grew up hunting in Colorado, and Emmett Smith, Alex's cousin, who recently took up hunting.
Shall we take a walk? And we'll have some...
Now, you're hearing all these leaves crunching because there's no snow on the ground, which for a big woods hunter like Alex is kind of a bummer.
So I grew up in Long Lake in the center of the Adirondacks, and around there for a lot of people, like, hunting season doesn't even really start till there's snow on the ground. I don't know if my dad knows when opening day is. He just, like, would go buy his hunting license when he saw snow in the forecast and go out, you know.
Following buck tracks through the snow is just the most straightforward way to hunt, at least in mountainous terrain. It's also the best way to hunt bigger bucks because you can actually tell deer tracks apart in the snow. But nowadays, you can't really count on snow falling in time for rifle season. And so hunters like Alex are making do by studying the more subtle clues that tell you where deer might be.
It's been a fun way to get better at hunting, to slow down more. And I feel like I get better shots that way, creeping up on deer and seeing more deer that don't see me than before.
So the day's lack of snow will dictate the day's slow and steady hunting strategy. We mostly walk along at a leisurely pace, sometimes through the very lovely woods and sometimes through some very unlovely brambles, looking for signs of deer. Emmett, Alex's cousin, notices something.
Straight there. You can kind of see the bare trees. You'll need to use your binoculars to see what I'm looking at.
Moose rub.
Moose?
Moose, yeah.
Okay. That makes sense. It's like, that's it.
Yeah,
not activity for a deer.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
that was a moose rub.
Because there are so many of us and the leaves mean we're making quite a bit of noise, Alex has decided we'll try and use sound to our advantage. He sets Bailey and Emmett up in these saddles, that's low points along the ridgeline, while Burgess, Alex, and I set up shop between them up top. Then Alex walks around, clanking these antlers together. Deer are pretty curious creatures, and the hope is that one of them will come see what sounds like two bucks fighting. So, just to recap, Alex has positioned two armed and hidden men on either side of himself, and then he's walking between them and impersonating the creature they're trying to kill. Burgess remarks on how funny this all sounds.
This feels like a dumb question, but it feels, crazy to go to set people up with guns around you and then walk around and
smack antlers together.
Yeah.
Blazed orange is a critical component of this play.
But on this Tuesday morning, the play doesn't work. After a totally deer-free hour, Alex calls Bailey and Emmett up the mountain. But Alex, an inveterate optimist, is not one for quitting. We will repeat this process several times in several spots across the mountain. No luck. In the afternoon, we try a new tactic that involves splitting up our party around a pond.
Great. Shoot straight.
No luck there either. And at this point, honestly, I've started to pray no one shoots a deer. I haven't been seized by doubts about the morality of hunting, to be clear. I'm just exhausted. We've been in the woods for 6 or 7 hours, and the last thing I want is to finish this hike by dragging a 150-pound carcass out of the woods. my wish comes true. No one kills a deer today. But we do talk about it, what it means to kill what you eat.
For very few people that I've ever been around, it's like a huge, you know, fist pumping experience to kill a deer. Like, it's, you know, it's a little somber.
To hunt something successfully, you kind of have to develop a reverence for the animal you're killing. At least that's true for Alex, and it's true for a lot of the hunters I talk to.
It's not like we're at war with deer, you know? Like, we love them. We also love to hunt them. We love to eat them, and they're, you know, you kill a deer and you get, you know, like a year's worth of meat, you know, which is a huge deal. So it's big, and it's we're very determined to do it, but it's, you know, it's certainly, it's heavy, and it gets heavier. I think the older I get, the, you know, the more time between pulling the trigger and getting excited it takes. They're just an amazing animal, you know.
At the end of the day, we're in Alex's truck getting a ride back to our cars. He asks us if we've caught the hunting bug, and I tell him, to be perfectly honest, no. I am not one for waking up this early to be that cold and that wet for that long. But I can honestly say that I am full of admiration for this uniquely difficult practice, and Alex gets it.
Whenever I'm explaining it to somebody who doesn't do it, it often sounds like a whole lot of things that wouldn't be very fun. I can see how, like, it's a collection of somewhat torturous events. And for some reason, it's totally under my skin. But it doesn't get under everybody's skin.
We'll be right back.
Brave Little State has support from Passumpsic Bank. Whether you're exploring options for a commercial equipment purchase or refinance of a new money loan, Passumpsic Bank can help you navigate your choices. Apply now through January 31st, 2025 to take advantage of special rates. More info at bankofthewild.com. Member FDIC. Loans are subject to credit approval. Limited time offer.
Podcasters aren't the only people who ask other people somewhat intrusive and occasionally indulgent questions about feelings and why they do whatever it is they do. Anthropologists like Mark Boglioli, they do that too.
You know, some of those questions are hard to answer.
Mark, who hunts and teaches at Drew University, wrote this book about hunting in contemporary Vermont called A Matter of Life and Death. And he's interested in the sorts of questions that I'm interested in, that Alex Larrabee is interested in, the why of it all. But he also had this professor back in the 90s who would kind of rib him about it.
And he would say, I can tell you why people hunt. It's not about how to feel about animals or some mystical thing, Mark. He goes, the reason they hunt is because they're male, they grew up in a rural area, they're white, and their father hunted. That's why they hunt.
Mark's professor was this guy named Tom Hepperlein, and he wrote this landmark paper with his wife Betty Thompson in the early 90s that foretold the end of hunting. Based on demographic trends, he predicted hunting as we know it would basically be extinct by 2050. It made a big splash in the hunting and conservation community. And over a quarter century later, a lot of people think Hepperlein was kind of prophetic. As America got less white and more urban, hunting participation rates did decline. But there's reason to think demographics may not necessarily be destiny.
In that basic, like, combination of, like, variables there, like the rural, the white, male, those things don't necessarily always stay the same. So that's why some of those predictions don't necessarily play out. For example, nationally, in the last 10 years, the numbers of women hunting has doubled.
And if you do a quick Google search on women's hunting apparel, it's considered a huge growth market. So part of the predicted losses have been made up by this new demographic, women entering the sport.
Some of those things really can't be predicted from the models from the 80s and 90s that kind of had a, you know, not an untrue, but a particular view of who a hunter was that might be changing.
Now, I'll note that Vermont appears to actually be lagging the rest of the country in terms of getting women into hunting. But the state data does show more women getting into the sport over time. Women like Nicole Meyer.
I'm a 36-year-old white woman who's all of 5 feet tall when I'm wearing like heels.
Nicole coordinates hunter education programs for Vermont Fish and Wildlife. You may notice that Nicole is not like other people you've heard from so far in this episode. She's not a man. Her dad didn't teach her how to hunt. And she came to hunting not as a kid, but as a young adult. It happened when she was working for the New York Department of Environmental Conservation after college.
I had this stereotype in my mind that all hunters were this Elmer Fudd type of guy who was really rednecky and dumb, and I was blown away at how wrong I was about my stereotypes of who a hunter is. I met this guy named Ed O'Connell, and he could tell you where a deer was going to be based on the temperature, the wind direction, and how much like sunlight there was. And I had never met someone who could communicate or know animals that intimately. I thought it was this superpower that he had, and that just kind of had me in a trance.
So at 22, Nicole picked up a gun for the first time. She took hunter education courses in a VFW with a bunch of 11 and 12-year-olds who knew every answer to the instructor's questions. She sat in the back and prayed she wouldn't get picked on. But eventually, she got the hang of it. The key was a good mentor, and that's something hunters can't emphasize enough. You really can't get into hunting unless someone is there next to you in the woods, walking you through every single step. Now, Nicole is one of the more than 3 million women who hunt in the United States. A U.S. Fish and Wildlife survey in 2022 found that 22% of all hunters in America are women. That's more than double the participation rates from 20 years ago. And there's also this other kind of person that's getting into hunting. People with more, shall we say, urbane sensibilities. People who like their food local, seasonal, and free range.
I gave a talk a few years ago at University of Wyoming on hipster hunters. Like, hipster hunter is a term now.
Mark Boglioli again.
For better or for worse, there's a lot more white guys with beards down to their waist driving Toyota Tacomas running to Vermont to gather edible plants. Like, who predicted that?
And Vermont is leaning really hard into this trend. That's not particularly surprising, given how big the local farm and food scene is here. Now, most of the people enrolling in hunter education courses, they're still mostly young boys from rural parts of the state. But Nicole says there's been a spike in adults showing up, mostly because of this interest in local food and self-sufficiency.
We're having these really fantastic conversations with people who think local food is important and that it's not so different to grow a zucchini in your garden and then eat it. That's not so different than going out hunting in your backyard and bringing home a squirrel to make squirrel pot pie, or a deer to make venison tacos, or whatever. It's been so.
This is why she's been traveling to farmers markets to hand out venison sliders. And it's why the state has started Vermont Wild Kitchen, a cooking class that brings local farmers, foragers, hunters, and anglers together to share recipes. So part of Alex Larrabee's winning question is about hunting trends in Vermont over time. Are there more hunters, less hunters? If you just looked at annual hunting license sales, you would think participation in hunting was falling off a cliff. For the past few decades, numbers have been going down, 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 even if you account for growth and demographics like women and quote-unquote hipster hunters. But it turns out it's really tough to tell an accurate story about these trends. That's because in the mid-90s, the state started offering the option of a lifetime permit.
Vermonters love a deal, and they've been exceedingly popular.
This is Chris Saunders, who handles license data for Vermont Fish and Wildlife. Today, you can buy an infant a lifetime hunting permit for a little over $200.
probably, you know, some years, 18 to 20% of all the infants born in Vermont are being gifted these licenses.
Basically, the people hunting with these lifetime permits, they were invisible in the state's annual license data for a while. In 2017, the state finally required people with these lifetime permits to register for free with the state each year if they were actually out in the field hunting. And overnight, there were over 12,000 additional hunters being captured by the state's tally. And except for this spike during the pandemic, between 2017 and 2023, the number of hunters has basically stayed the same at 70,000.
There are fewer people hunting than there were in the 70s and 80s. That is undeniable. But at least last 5 years, and I think the last 10 years at least, hunting participation has been pretty darn stable.
Now, before anyone accuses Chris or I of being Pollyannas about the state of hunting in Vermont, demographics do present a challenge. That, of course, should surprise absolutely nobody that's read a single article about the state of Vermont in the last 10 years. Participation rates are higher with older Vermonters than with younger Vermonters. And those older Vermonters, they will eventually age out of the sport. But honestly, when I've talked to hunters about their anxieties around the future of the sport, what really concerns them isn't whether we'll run out of hunters. It's whether we'll run out of land. You don't need to come from a rural place to hunt. An urban transplant can learn just fine. But you do need a rural landscape to hunt. And as more and more people post their land and sprawl creeps into the hills, the forest increasingly becomes off limits to hunters. And for hunters like Nicole, connection to the land isn't just necessary to hunt. It's also kind of the whole point.
The intimacy that you have with nature when you're hunting and trying to be part of the environment is, it's unparalleled, it's beautiful. I was hunting a flock of turkeys one spring, and I was just too far off to get a shot. And then out of the corner of my eye, I see this movement down this hillside, and it was a bobcat coming down the hill slowly, and I realized the bobcat was hunting the same turkeys that I was hunting. And there was part of me that was like, yes, you get those turkeys. I want to see that. That is amazing. And there's part of me that's like, oh, no, you don't. Those are my turkeys. So it kind of felt like I'm obviously not a bobcat, but it felt like I was a predator too. I didn't shoot a turkey that day. That was one of my best days of hunting ever.
Sally, for the big jug of vinegar.
Yeah.
And oh, maybe actually, can you wash that knife too while you're at it?
I'm back at Alex Smith's place. That's our hunter guide from earlier, in a wood shop behind his house. And right now I'm looking at a fairly gory scene, a large rib cage and spine with most of the meat cut away. There's also some bloodshot meat off to the side, which can't get processed because that's where Alex's bullet struck through the deer's neck.
So yeah, that's the unusable portion of a, you know, 150-pound buck. That and the height and head, like I said.
This is the deer Alex bagged on the opening day of Vermont's rifle season, a few days before our less successful outing. He's agreed to let me watch as he processes what's left of it. Because we've had a bit of a warm spell, Alex couldn't leave the deer hanging to cure. Instead, he skinned and quartered it, storing the backstraps and shoulders in three large coolers on the floor. Now he's taking maybe 15 pounds of flesh out of those coolers at a time and butchering it into smaller pieces.
You know, it's not rocket science with the deer. It really is basically just separating muscles out, you know.
It's pretty remarkable how much meat a deer can provide. The two that Alex shot this season will provide his family of four the bulk of their meat through the year. But Alex jokes that when his two boys get older and start eating the way he once did, they're going to have to start pulling their own weight in the game department. And that's when his cousin, Emmett, chimes in with a joke.
Well, you can start picking them up off the road, too.
Yeah, no, nab them off the road. We could take them anywhere we can get them. People are quick to jump on the roadkill in Addison County. I like that about this place.
Yesterday, too. I feel like
Emmett got into hunting from having a bad roadkill year.
Now, Emmett isn't alone. Plenty of people salvage roadkill for food here in Vermont and have for a long time. There's even a state program for it. But while some people might turn to roadkill when they have a bad hunting year, Emmett did the opposite. He says it started because his ex didn't eat farmed animal products.
But she would eat game, and she had gotten into the habit of picking up roadkill and taught me the fine art of it.
Emmett explains that his ex, she was a vegan because of climate change. But if you're thinking about your food's carbon footprint, roadkill is kind of unimpeachable.
I'm having a little self-conscious moment here being with this microphone. You know how, like, the weirdest thing about you becomes the thing that everybody finds out about first?
Oh, you're right.
Right. So, yeah. This is something that often comes up at dinner parties, you know, whether roadkill's on the menu or not.
Remember the wave of so-called hipster hunters our anthropologist friend Mark was describing earlier? Emmett fits the bill. He came to hunting from an interest in sustainability, and when we were out hunting, he was using a vintage rifle, a Winchester Model 94, the hipsterest of hipster guns, according to Alex. Growing up, Emmett's dad didn't hunt. Neither did his friend group of art kids, punks, and nerds. In high school, he might not have fit in with those hunter boys in Danville you heard at the beginning of this story. But now that he's out in the woods, he sure sounds a lot like them to me.
I think one of the things I find most rewarding about it is it forces you to be really mindful in the moment, forces you to be really present. You can go from being in the woods, seeing an animal, taking the animal, taking it apart, going through all of the emotions involved in that. And it is a very emotional process that I think we're very separated from in most of our meat consumption. And every part of that is just... it's not always easy, but it's rewarding, and it's sort of essential to the human experience in a way that is very meaningful.
Alex Larrabee asked us two questions. She wanted to know how many people hunt and why they hunt. And maybe this is where Tom Heberlein, the famous sociologist who foretold the end of hunting, maybe got it a little wrong when he collapsed both those questions. Remember when he told Mark that people hunt because they're men, they're rural, and their dads hunted? That may be how most people got into hunting in the 70s and 80s. But I don't think that's why they hunted then, at least not primarily. And it's not why people hunt now. Because whether you're a rural kid who inherited the tradition from your dad, or an urban transplant who got into the sport later in life, I think it really is about how you feel about animals, or nature, or some mystical thing.
Do you eat meat that's not hunted or roadkill anymore?
I do, yeah. I don't make any claim to ethical purity, I guess, on that front.
I make a lot of claims towards purity in that department until I see a Stewart's chili dog. I eat free-range organic venison and Stewart's chili dogs.
Thanks for listening to the show, and thanks to Alex Larrabee for the great question. And a very big thank you to every single teacher and administrator, there are far too many to list individually, that helped us connect with Vermont students. To see photos from our hunting expedition and for a full episode transcript, head to bravelittlestate.org. While you're there, submit your own question about life in Vermont that you want us to consider for a future episode. This episode was reported by Lola Dufour. It was produced by me, Burgess Brown, and edited by Sabine Pooks and Josh Crane. Digital support from Sophie Stevens. Angela Evansy is Brave Little State's executive producer. Our theme music is by Ty Gibbons. Other music by Blue Dot Sessions. Special thanks to Abigail Giles, Travis Tremblay, Mike Covey, Matt Breton, Rachel Keach, Natalie Conway, and Chris Bray. Brave Little State is a production of Vermont Public and a proud member of the NPR network. We'll be back with more listener-powered Vermont journalism. Talk soon.
Hey, Vermont. Mitch Wertlieb here, and I host a daily news podcast from Vermont Public called The Frequency. You'll hear top stories from our newsroom in less than 15 minutes every weekday morning. Connect with our state when you search for The Frequency wherever you like to find podcasts. We're a proud member of the NPR network.